I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Robert Roberson remains on Texas death row. Texas had planned to execute him on October 17th, despite the overwhelming amount of evidence that he is likely innocent and there was no crime. Still, the executioner waits. We get an update on Roberson and his case. But the Texas death machine carries on, and we're going to hear about the next man scheduled to die. Stephen Nelson's February 5th death date looms. Exploring the complex issues of the Texas death penalty is laid out in the documentary I'm Ready, Warden, and it's nominated for an Academy Award. We're going to hear from the film's director. And President Donald Trump is issuing executive orders on the death penalty. He wants more executions, and he wants them now. That's what's coming up on this special edition of The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A little later, we're going to be hearing from the director of the Oscar-nominated short documentary, I Am Ready, Warden, which examines the death penalty in Texas. We also get an update on Robert Roberson. How is he doing on death row still? Why is he still facing execution? But first, the next execution scheduled for Texas is February 5th, and the condemned is Stephen Nelson. Texas Observer staff writer Michelle Pitcher reports that for the supporters of the death penalty, Nelson is practically a poster child.
In Texas, there's this idea of the law of parties, which basically means that in specific situations, you can be held criminally responsible even if someone else commits a murder. And one application of this is something called felony murder. And that's when someone's killed in the course of committing another felony, like robbery or burglary. So if you agree to, say, rob a church with someone and anyone in the group ends up killing someone within the church during the robbery, everyone who agreed to the plan could be tried under the law of parties. So in Stephen's case, this is a capital murder case. And in order to convict someone of capital murder under the law of parties, the jury has to determine that the person should have known that the murder was a potential outcome. So they would have anticipated it even if they didn't pull the trigger.
Right. So there have been some attempts in Texas to take the death penalty away from the law of parties. There's one thing to convict someone for a law of parties, but nothing to put them to death. Is that really the dividing line?
Yeah. So it gets complicated, too. So a little case information. Stephen Nelson was convicted for capital murder after a robbery of a church in 2011. And in the course of that robbery, the pastor, Clinton Dobson, was killed. And so when Stephen went to trial, he said that he was the lookout for the robbery, and two other men actually committed the assault and murder. The jury, when it convicted Stephen of capital murder, didn't say whether it actually thought that Stephen had committed the murder himself or if he was just being convicted under this law of parties. So in Stephen Nelson's case, it is a bit blurrier. But I do think that in general, there have been a fair number of people sentenced to death in Texas on this law of parties. So it's not uncommon by any means.
Well, it seems like they didn't have to crystallize that question and get a good answer. Did he actually participate in the murders? Because it didn't matter as far as the jury was concerned or the prosecution. He was there. He took place in a robbery. Therefore, he's just as guilty.
Exactly. Yeah. And some of his supporters say that it doesn't actually matter which is true, which he ended up being convicted on, because even if he was the one that committed the murder, they're opposing his execution.
Right. And he did participate in the looting after the murders. So he stole stuff, even though people were killed.
Yeah. And when I spoke with his spiritual advisor, Jeff Hood, he said that, you know, best case scenario, he stepped over people who were dying to, take a laptop and some credit cards. So it, you know, people talk about this not being a case where we have a poster child for innocence. And so it's a particularly poignant one to look at, especially after, October saw a big push for Robert Roberson. He was the last one to face the death penalty in Texas. And this is just such a stark contrast of a case.
People who are on death row, there are some. There are questions about their guilt or innocence, and there are some who there's not a lot of questions about their guilt or innocence. And still the question, though, of whether or not Texas should be putting people to death or not. And this mm-hmm. seems to, he'd done so since he was in juvenile.
Yeah, I think his first interaction with police was maybe at 6 years old. So yeah, when he was a little kid, and he had a really long record by the time that that this 2011 murder occurred.
One of the arguments that's supposed to be presented during the sentencing of a capital murder case, you have to argue as a prosecutor that this person will be an ongoing threat to society, even if they are incarcerated. And it does seem like Nelson would be a threat, because apparently he had been accused of killing a fellow inmate, and they didn't pursue that charge because he was already set for the death penalty. But that's something that, you know, is weighed in a death penalty case.
Right. And one thing that his lawyers actually did bring up was that during his trial, one of the defense expert witnesses actually testified that she believed he would be a future threat. And, it's argued in the filings that her basis for that was racist. It is worth noting that while he was in the Tarrant County Jail, he was a violent or categorized as an assaultive inmate. But, you know, the people who have known him over the past 5 years kind of reject the idea that he is still that person. And obviously they say that they can't know because they didn't know that man. But it's always an interesting question, because in Texas we do require juries to decide whether someone is going to be a future danger. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about how that can actually be answered.
It's a philosophical question as well. Should my present self be held responsible for the crimes committed by my past self? Mm-hmm. And we have decided as a society, the answer is yes. That's called accountability. Mm-hmm. But the central question about the death penalty, about Texas and about the morality or the justification of the vengeance question of the death penalty in Texas with Stephen Nelson, is it seemed like here's a person who was a career criminal. He participated in a robbery that turned into a murder. And, you have to ask yourself, well, maybe this is the person that the death penalty was created for. He seems to, you know, line up with all the objectives that people who are in favor of the death penalty think about. And if you object to that, then you just object to the death penalty on moral, ethical grounds.
Yeah, and I think another thing that's come up in this case is, you know, the crime took place in a church in Arlington in 2011. So there is this kind of faith aspect of it, where some of his supporters, including his spiritual advisor, who's a Catholic faith leader, are saying that it's an incompatible idea to support the death penalty for someone if you are a church leader, from like the principles of Christianity. So I think that that's also an interesting kind of juxtaposition that we're able to see with this case, because the crime actually occurred at a church.
Right. And apparently it's being reported that some of those church members are kind of divided on that question, while some saying, you know, they want the execution carried out, others in that same congregation are saying no, they urge forgiveness, that the execution would actually solve nothing and it would not accomplish anything except to just show how violence leads to more violence.
Yeah, it seems like within that community, it's like a microcosm of kind of how divided Texans in general are over the question of the death penalty in 2025.
Michelle Pitcher is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. And when we come back, a documentary about the Texas death penalty goes to the Oscars. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're taking a look at the Texas death penalty today. A documentary about the execution of John Henry Ramirez has gained attention and is nominated for the Academy Award. Ramirez was executed on October 5th, 2022, for the 2004 murder of Pablo Castro, a convenience store clerk in Corpus Christi. Ramirez stabbed Castro 29 times, leaving him to die in the parking lot. Ramirez fled to Mexico, but he was arrested in 2008 and sentenced to die in 2009. But in the documentary, I Am Ready, Warden, they explore much more than those facts of the case.
We each have our own free will.
I'll never be able to make amends for taking a life. I'm a murderer.
I'll never overcome it.
I was 14. I remember waking up to police sirens and lights and see my father's body on the ground.
This man stabbed somebody 29 times.
The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles unanimously denied clemency for John Henry Ramirez.
In the interest of justice, our office shouldn't be involved in murdering Texas citizens.
I just had all the anger and hate in the world.
I always said, I'm going to be a better father than my dad.
I don't think if I would have stayed free, you would have grew up to be who you are right now.
John asked me, would you be my godmother? He is just not that person he was then.
Due process was done. Now we're changing our moral judgment.
What will you gain if I die, if I sink into the grave?
You're going to just forgive and that's it? He should pay for what he did.
I made the most changes I could. I bettered myself as much as I could, and that's enough.
I love you.
I spoke to the director of I Am Ready, Warden, Smithy Mundra, and the producer, Maya Knipt. Smithy, how did y'all come to take on this topic? How did this become on your radar and you wanted to produce a documentary on the death penalty in Texas, particularly with John Henry Ramirez?
Yeah. So I had previously been working on another project, which was a feature documentary about another death row case. That was actually an innocence case. It was sort of a more traditional kind of true crime story, but it was another prisoner in the same unit, Polensky unit. And that project fell apart, you know, when there were some legal developments that required the lawyers to close ranks around that prisoner. And so we couldn't really proceed with that project. But at that point, you know, I was, you know, sort of deeply embedded, you know, in the world of death row cases, and Polensky and that environment in particular was in a lot of the Facebook groups and had talked to a lot of people. And I still was really compelled about making something on this topic. But actually, you know, if I were to start again, you know, I had Maya and I talked initially that what I really wanted to do is was make a film that wasn't about an innocence case, that was about a man, you know, who had a prisoner who had actually committed a crime, and make a film that really kind of examined our capacity for forgiveness. And so in my research, I'd come across the writing of Carrie Blakinger, who was at the time a journalist for the Marshall Project, and just was really moved by her writing, really, really moved by her writing, particularly the pieces she had written about the men on death row, and thought that she wrote about them with so much humanity and about the subject with so much sensitivity. And so I reached out to her and asked if she would want to collaborate. And that's how it started.
And Maya, how receptive were you to this idea that this was something that could be covered, could be put together, you would have access, and it would be something that audiences would respond to?
Well, I think the really key piece here that that Smithy mentioned was actually Kerry's involvement as well, because it's through her that we were able to really connect with John sort of from the very, very beginning. As I'm sure you know, it's very hard to interview death row prisoners. You can only do it sort of once every six months that you can have access. So we would only really have access to John for just a few interviews throughout the film and throughout the production period. But it meant that from the very beginning, and the way that we set it up, it was three people could go in. So it would be Kerry, Smithy, and our DP. So Smithy would be there, and you know, she would of course sort of write her questions, but it would actually be Kerry for the most part. There was going some back and forth as well, but sort of especially the first few questions were coming from Kerry. So that was already an established relationship that John had, and we could sort of make up a lot of time and sort of and ground to be able to make this film.
And now the film's been nominated for an Academy Award. That means there's going to be a lot more attention on it. So Smithy, the people looking at the film, and it's more than just a story about death row and executions. It's a story about faith. It's a story about fathers and sons. Mm-hmm. And we live in a violent society, and what we make of all that. So when they describe it, you know, here's the nominee, short documentary about death row. Do you want to say, well, no, there's a lot going on in this short film?
Absolutely. And thank you for noticing all of that, because, you know, it Maya and I and all the work that we've done together, we don't really set out to make topical, you know, tell stories that are topical. We tell stories that are universal and deeply human. And I think the aspect of this that connects to all of my other work, you know, and I do a pretty diverse range of work. You know, probably what people know me the most for is a dating show that I created on Netflix called Indian Matchmaking. But I think the common theme of all of my work is that it really examines parent-child relationships, you know, and how those relationships impact us and shape us. And I think the father-son relationships in this film are core to sort of what makes people connect, you know, with each of the characters and see themselves in a place that they may never experience personally. You know, somebody may not be able to connect with John on any other level, but when you hear him talking to his son for the final time, it's impossible to not be moved by that. You know, it's impossible to not be moved by that. And honestly, I lost my father, you know, unexpectedly, you know, a dozen years ago. And I never got to have that final conversation with him, you know? So I think about that a lot when I hear that conversation. As tragic as it is, I also, in a strange way, wish I could have had that conversation with my father, you know, before he passed away. Aaron didn't get a chance to have that conversation with his father. So yeah, I think that is the core. I think that's what takes the film beyond sort of a political film or an agenda-driven film, and something that I think no matter what your perspective is on this particular topic, how you feel about John, how you feel about Aaron, it's impossible to not empathize with them.
And Maya, so this is not a pro or anti-death penalty documentary.
I think that naturally happens in the fact that when we spend time with our subjects, we really do get to know them in a really intimate way. So I think their humanity just comes to the fore. And I think as we edit the film, that really leads the way. So we really do just try and paint a portrait. And I have found it really interesting the way that people are watching this film and how they're reading the message for themselves. When I was in Australia, because the film is available there, I was there last month. Some people did have a sort of a reaction to it where they felt like, well, there is a little bit of resolution at the end of all of this. And they actually felt like they sort of thought, well, maybe this did help some people to have that resolution, whereas a lot of other people felt like, well, I feel as though this has just opened up fresh wounds. So I have heard sort of both perspectives from audiences sort of around the world.
Smithy, so I've been working a lot on the Robert Roberson case in Texas. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed him on death row, and I've covered it extensively. And he is, according to a substantial amount of evidence that shows that he committed no crime and is innocent on death row. And the state of Texas is aggressively has tried to execute him despite the predominance, all this evidence that's there. So there is there are stories to be told on death row about guilt and innocence. I mean, why weren't you just drawn to try and tell a story like that?
I think that there is, I think those stories are very worthy, and they can actually, you know, we've seen that they can change outcomes, you know, of cases. They can change outcomes of public opinion. And I think those stories are really worthy, but they inevitably become about that case. You know, they don't necessarily force us to examine the entire system. And they don't necessarily force us to confront our values, you know. And I like to make films that ask a question of the audience, you know, and ask the audience to participate in sort of what we think that the world should look like, you know. And I think the question for the audience in this case was that, can you look at someone who had admitted to committing a heinous crime, killed somebody, took a life, and accept that they've changed and believe that they deserve forgiveness and deserve to be redeemed? When it comes to faith, you know, like if we, especially in Texas, you know, people talk a lot about faith and Christianity and, you know, things like that, you know, we do believe in that, but in practice, do we? So that's, I really wanted to examine that. And I felt like that was something different. We don't often see a lot of films, you know, that look at that perspective. And I thought that was compelling and underexplored.
And the district attorney, Mark Gonzalez, Oasis County, Corpus Christi, now former district attorney, he was removed under sort of a political maneuver. He's an interesting character. And he's tatted up. He's a former gang member. And yet he's the one that wants to withdraw the death penalty warrant. And the system won't allow him to do that. I mean, that tells a story about how the system in Texas is almost like a predatory animal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And you're probably, you know, you've been covering the Roberson case and you're probably seeing it there as well, you know. I think whether it's through policy or through rhetoric, you know, we are, you know, hurtling in a direction as a society where we just don't accept any nuance anywhere. You know, whether it comes to the way we treat people, you know, we write people off, we throw them away. Whether it comes to policy that, you know, only will look at, you know, people as polar opposites, you know, you're either, you know, a victim or a hero, you're either, you know, wrong or you're right. There's really little room for nuance. And I think we see that reflected in policy as well. You know, we don't really, and I think that's really what we hope to sort of,
I was going to say, certainty is a sign of ignorance. If you can accept the fact that you don't know and there's room to learn, that intellectual humility, that's where you can grow.
Exactly. And accept that people can change, right? I mean, I think Aaron had, you know, he is a victim in all of this. There was no incentive for him to change his point of view and change his heart. He goes through dramatic change, you know, in the film. Mark Gonzalez, as you mentioned, you know, he really swam against the tide within a political system where he was already an improbable, you know, district attorney. And it would have been very easy for him to just, you know, he's in there and try to hold on, you know, as long as possible and go along to get along. But he took a chance, you know, because of his own beliefs to try to change the system. You know, it's not that easy. People aren't always successful. But I think that the more we can shed light on the people who are trying and who do see that nuance and, you know, who are open to that kind of change, I think we really need that as a culture right now, because we've become way too polarized, way too absolutist. and way too willing to throw people away.
Smithy Mundra is the director of I Am Ready Warden, and Maya Nipt is the producer. Their film examines the death penalty in Texas. It's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Short Documentary. And when we come back, we get an update on Robert Roberson and the efforts to avoid his execution. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/EDD/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 2024, one of the top stories of the year was Robert Roberson's and his attempt to avoid being executed. The East Texas man was convicted in 2003 for the death of his two-year-old daughter, Nikki Curtis. Prosecutors alleged that in January of 2022, Roberson violently shook Nikki, leading to a fatal head injury, a diagnosis commonly referred to as shaken baby syndrome. At that time, shaken baby syndrome was widely accepted in the medical community as a cause for severe brain injuries in infants. However, in the years following Roberson's conviction, the scientific foundation of shaken baby syndrome has come under significant scrutiny. It's now considered by many to be junk science. In Roberson's case, new medical evidence indicates that Nikki died from severe viral and bacterial pneumonia, which progressed to sepsis and septic shock, which could explain her symptoms and her death without being physically abused. But the courts never heard or considered this new evidence. The appeals process continued to reject hearing it and also calls for a new trial. Also, after his trial, Roberson's defense also highlighted that he was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. This diagnosis suggests that his perceived lack of emotion during the investigation and during the trial, a factor that continued to contribute to suspicion against him, was a manifestation of his neurodevelopmental condition rather than an indication of guilt. Despite these developments, Roberson's appeals for a new trial were consistently denied. His execution was scheduled for October 17, 2024. In a last-minute effort to prevent what many believed would be a grave miscarriage of justice, the Texas House Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence issued a subpoena for Roberson to testify, effectively delaying his execution. This unprecedented move underscored the growing concern about the validity of his conviction and the potential execution of an innocent man. Roberson's case has garnered widespread attention with support from medical experts, legal professionals, and advocacy groups who argue that his conviction was based on outdated and questionable science. Roberson remains, though, on death row today, and he still could be executed despite all of this new evidence. Gretchen Swin is Roberson's attorney.
Right now, Robert is back to his old self of feeling very hopeful and optimistic about someday being able to get back to his wife and taking care of his adult children. But he's been on quite the emotional roller coaster because he simply did not understand all of these legal and political maneuvers to try to keep him from coming to the Capitol and testifying. He really wanted to do that, saw that as a sign that people in the outside world cared and, you know, valued what he had to say. And then he just, you know, he's a person with, you know, below average IQ and a lifelong developmental disability. So these kinds of complexities are hard to explain to him. And it was just very painful watching him suffer through all that after, you know, the trauma of, you know, coming within minutes of execution.
Well, there's no shame in not really understanding what is going on legalized and with the legislature, because it's confusing to everybody.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think that, you know, this is a unique situation, but the fact is there's now a published decision from the Texas Supreme Court saying the lawmakers had every right to subpoena anybody they want, and that includes a prisoner on death row. And yet somehow that was blocked by the Attorney General's office, which should, in fact, under Texas law, be cooperating and helping enable lawmakers from taking people's testimony. So it is quite the mystery.
Well, to be clear, is Robert in imminent danger of being executed right now?
I would say yes and no. If imminent means within the next few days, no, because there is no pending execution date. And the power to seek a new execution date lies completely in the hands of the local district attorney in Anderson County. And to my knowledge, she has not yet moved to seek a new date. And in fact, there's no presiding judge, as far as I know, since the trial judge who had been assigned to this case moved voluntarily to recuse herself in November. After initially there had been resistance to that, she then voluntarily recused, and there's been no new judge assigned, at least not that I've been informed of.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the presiding judge issue, because that judge, you had filed a request for them to be removed from this case because they had shown inability to actually hear arguments and actually try to be objective in deciding, about the Robert's guilt or innocence in this case. So that seems to be something that could actually change in moving forward.
Well, let me clarify that under Texas law, a judge is supposed to recuse voluntarily or by direction of another judge if you produce evidence that there is an appearance of a lack of impartiality. So you don't have to prove actual bias, but the appearance of bias. And yes, we did feel we more than produced evidence suggesting that this judge in this particular case was showing an inability to look objectively at the facts. And this was extremely concerning since this is a case involving an assertion of actual innocence. And that the judges are humans and they have relationships with people. And in this particular judge, it turns out, has a friendship with the district attorney and with many people that were involved in the past in this case in ways that, may explain that. But in any case, the inexplicable decisions, which just ignored all of the new evidence of innocence, only made sense if one said, perhaps this judge is not seeing this case objectively the way others who look at it objectively see it. But in any event, whoever is appointed at the trial level will not be able to just say, let me reexamine this. That will still have to be a matter to take to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the only court that could possibly decide whether Robert gets a chance at a new trial.
Have all those appeals been exhausted?
Well, long ago, all mandatory appeals were exhausted, but one is always allowed to try to get back into court and show that there has been a change in the facts or the law, or in this case, the science, that warrants going forward and reopening the case. We failed at that over and over and over, but we're not giving up, because every day the science that was used to obtain this conviction has been exposed as completely baseless. And there are new studies, there are new exonerations, with each passing week. But that is the challenge. What will be new since October of 2024? That's what we're that's our burden.
So a new death warrant would have to be issued by the district attorney in Anderson County. And but we've seen sometimes it could take years for them to get around to doing things like this.
Right. It's not the district attorney has to initiate the process, and only a court then can set a date. But yes, I mean, there have been people whose dates have never been sought because of, you know, all kinds of reasons. The law gives the discretion, this very powerful decision over life and death, really, to the local district attorney where the case was tried. And we strongly hope that after all that has been brought to light, maybe that's causing her to pause and finally reexamine this case, because this is not a person who tried the case, and she admitted in a public hearing before state lawmakers that she wasn't familiar with the new evidence of innocence. She hadn't reviewed the new medical reports. So maybe that's what's going on. That would be my fervent hope.
So it's one thing to not execute Robert, but if you understand the facts of the case, he committed no crime. So he is still locked up for something he didn't do.
Correct. And until we have a chance to get a new trial, which is just to authorize us to then now take on the state's case based on all that has been uncovered in the last 20 plus years. I mean, he is still, according to the state, convicted of capital murder. The only way to unwind that, despite, you know, anybody who reads this stuff objectively is deeply disturbed, you know, but it's the court system that has the power to unwind this. And it still would mean, it wouldn't mean he'd walk out the door. It would mean, you know, we go and fight the conviction through a new trial.
Gretchen Swin is Robert Robertson's attorney. Robertson remains on death row in Texas with no death date set for now. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. When we come back, what President Donald Trump is doing to try to execute more people. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The data about the use of the death penalty in Texas and across the nation shows that it is in a historic decline. In 2024, Texas executed 5 individuals, marking the 6th consecutive year with fewer than 10 executions in the state. This continues a trend of declining use of the death penalty in Texas. But note, 3 condemned men who faced execution dates in 2024 did not die. They received stays. Overall, the United States carried out 25 executions in 2024, with Texas accounting for 5 of them. There is a trend of fewer executions now, but President Donald Trump is not happy about that. And on his first day in office, he signed an executive order aimed at reinstating and expanding the use of the federal death penalty. Robert Dunham is the director of the Death Penalty Policy Project.
Well, I think it's really interesting because we have to draw a distinction here between policy and politics. The executive order, I think, really falls in the category of politics. The suggestion that states should seek the death penalty more frequently actually is completely contrary to what's been going on. The Death Penalty Policy Project just finished a review of 50 years of death penalty data. And what it shows is that the decline in the size of death row nationally in 2024 was the greatest in 21 years. And it was the highest single year proportional decline, percentage decline in the size of death row since 1976, when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down all mandatory death penalty laws. So what we see is that actually the death penalty nationwide is in decline. In 2023, for the first time in the modern history of the U.S. death penalty, there were fewer new death sentences than there were executions. And that was with both executions and death sentences at near generational lows. So the death penalty is now in a state where it isn't even sustaining itself. The size of death row has dropped for 24 straight years. So the political statement that the Trump administration is favoring expanded use of the death penalty flies in the face of the practical reality that people across the country are rejecting capital punishment.
Still, on his first day in office, Trump signs executive order aimed at reinstating and expanding the use of the federal death penalty. So he wants to have more death penalty.
I think that's certainly true. That's something that he wanted to do in his first term and did with an historic execution spree, more executions in 6 months than at any time since the 1800s when it comes to the federal death penalty. But the fact of the matter is that whatever expansion is attempted right now in terms of capital prosecutions at the federal level aren't going to result in any executions during the next 4 years. And the commutations by President Biden, removing 37 people out of the 40 who are on federal death row, will make it so that there probably won't be any executions of the people who had previously been sentenced to death. And that's, again, why I would suggest that the statement, although it's certainly something that's an expression of his intent, is more political than it is in terms of any practical impact.
So when President Biden, when he converted 37 of their death penalties to life sentences, Donald Trump reacted by acting as if it was an affront to him. He took it as a personal insult to him. And he seems to be reacting in a way to actually punish those individuals who are now will be serving life in prison.
Well, that's not out of character. What we have to remember there is that the federal prisons have a system for determining how somebody should be housed when they are subject to a particular sentence. And each of the people who are formerly on death row and who received commutations now will be serving sentences of life without parole. There is a system that is set in place for determining what kind of risks they pose in terms of security within the prisons. There are rules that the federal prisons have to apply. You cannot single out somebody because of a prior sentencing status to treat them differently than they would have been treated had they been sentenced to life without parole in the first place. So there will be an assessment, an individualized assessment, based on the risk that a prisoner poses in prison. That assessment can't constitutionally have anything to do with the fact that they've received commutations.
Right. Wouldn't that be a violation of the cruel and unusual punishment? Because this is not usual.
Yes. And not just that it's not usual, but also because you cannot single out individuals for punishment. If the legislature did it, it would be what's called a bill of attainder. And for the same reason that the legislature cannot pass legislation to specifically target an individual for punishment, an executive can't do that either. And that's not something that we would expect that the Federal Bureau of Prisons would do. They have their protocol to follow, and we expect that that's what they will do.
Donald Trump also signed an order that mandates efforts to ensure that the states that have the death penalty have adequate supplies of lethal injection drugs to carry out executions. Was there a federal law that prohibited them from having these drugs? I mean, will this executive order actually do anything?
Taking Texas, for example, Texas already has the drugs that it's using to carry out executions. So the states that have been in the business of carrying out executions probably will not be affected by this. The question is going to be whether there are some states on the margin who say that they have not been able to obtain those drugs. I think the real problem here is that after the Biden administration took a look at the federal lethal injection protocol, they issued an order, Attorney General Merrick Garland issued an order towards the end of his time in office in which he rescinded the federal protocol, particularly because the drugs that the new administration wants to make available result in torturous executions. And so the first time that there was a government review of the, I don't want to say viability, but but the acceptability of the federal execution protocol, the review suggested that it is akin to being exposed to waterboarding and suffocation and torture, and that it's not something that the federal government or states should adopt. So when the Trump administration says that it wants to make those drugs available, states, I think, have to consider very seriously whether they want to be engaging in executions using chemicals that a thorough review of the execution process has found to be torturous.
Trump has said, or he's indicated, that he still wants to execute the people that were granted clemency by Biden. Is there any way that he could still try to do that?
No. A grant of clemency, a commutation of a sentence, is final. And just as the commutations of the individuals who were involved in the January 6th insurrection can't be reversed by future presidents, the clemency granted to the individuals who formerly were on federal death row also cannot be reversed.
But Trump is calling for more uses of the death penalty. He has said in the past, he said during his campaign, that he wanted to use the death penalty for drug dealers. And now he says he wants to use the death penalty more like summary judgment death penalty, killing people on site for drug cartel members. So there's a lot more coming.
I think that the administration does intend to try to expand the use of the death penalty. And the two areas that they have spoken about the most are cases involving the killings of police officers and drug-related cases. I think the most important thing to understand here, though, is, does this make a contribution to public safety? And we were very concerned at the Death Penalty Policy Project about the public safety issue, because if the death penalty does make police safer and does make the public safer, that's a substantial reason to have it. So we reviewed 30 years of FBI data on homicides in general and homicides of police officers in particular. What we found was that the public and police are actually safer in states that don't have the death penalty than in states that do. And police officers, it turned out, were safest for whatever reason in states that had most recently abolished capital punishment. What that tells us is that seeking the death penalty in police killings does nothing to make police safer. And if we're interested in making police safer, we should look at things that might actually bring that about. The second thing is
Let me just pause you right there. Like, that would be something like remove guns from our communities, because that seems to be the problem.
Well, that's certainly one of the things that the reformers have suggested. Another thing is community policing, because when you improve police-community relations, things get safer both for the community and for the police. So there are things short of gun regulations that could make police safer and could make the public safer.
But Donald Trump is calling this, he's Make America Safe Again. He says the reason why he's always been so enthusiastic for the use of the death penalty throughout his career in the public's eye. And he's always said that this is going to make us safer.
Yes, he has said that. And the problem with that statement is that it isn't true. None of the facts show that the death penalty is a deterrent, and especially it is not a greater deterrent than other possible punishments. The evidence that does exist, as I said, suggests from looking at the history of whether you have the death penalty or you don't, and 30 years of homicide data, it shows that the death penalty has not made the public safer. You cannot execute your way into public safety. You have to take a look at public policies that actually may have an impact on the social conditions that lead to crime and things that could prevent crime. When you do that, as many of the states that don't have the death penalty have done, not having the death penalty has given them the leeway to look at these other alternatives. That's how you make the public safer. The death penalty doesn't do that.
Robert Dunham is the director of the Death Penalty Policy Project. That wraps up this edition of The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.